Undisciplined is a collaboration between African and African-American studies at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
The podcast provides a peek into the complex issues that affects our interconnected world.
Taking the interdisciplinary approach of African and African-American studies to the classroom, into the community, onto the airwaves, and beyond. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton, and for this sixth season, I have a new co-host,
Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get into it. Welcome back, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Undisciplined Podcast. As you know, we'd like to bridge the gap between the academy and what's happening out there in public life, bringing you what scholars, what people in the community, you know, what students are doing, thinking about researching, and have those conversations. And today we are very pleased, Karenisi and I, to bring a whole new guest with a very interesting topic that has been making headlines, I think, over the last couple of years, a subject that is of deep interest to myself as a historian as well. So today we are very pleased to bring you Elena Roberts. Elena Roberts, just for you out there listening, will be giving the kind of lecture here at the University of Arkansas this month. So we are happy that she was able to join us before giving this lecture on the Undisciplined podcast. She is an award-winning historian who studies the intersection of Black and Native American life, which us being at this side of the country, we love to know more about, right? She's going from the Civil War to the modern day. And this is something that comes from her own family history. Her father's ancestors survived Indian removal Trail of Tears and were owned as slaves by the Chickasaw and Choctaw Indians. And she is currently an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. She holds a doctorate in history from Indiana University and a Bachelor of Arts in history with honors from the University of California at Santa Barbara. She writes, teaches, and presents public talks about Black and Native history in the West, family history, slavery in the Five Tribes, the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole Indian nations, Native American enrollment politics, and indigeneity in North America and across the globe. And we are here because she has this fascinating book. I've been here all the while, Black Freedom on Native Land. And so if, for our listeners, if you want to pick up a copy of that, it's available for purchase at Amazon, as well as a variety of other bookstores. But please join us today in welcoming Dr. Elena Roberts.
Welcome.
Good morning. Wonderful. Or I guess whatever time you're listening to this.
Yes.
We're glad you're here. You know, I think about this one experience I had in my, when I was getting my master's at the University of Texas at Austin. And we had a Native woman from the Potawatomi tribe who was in our program. And I said, oh, yeah, girl, you know, I got some Native American in me. And I said, I got some Indian in my blood. And so, you know, later on, she tells me, you know, I get kind of offended by that because there's so much more than just being having something in your blood. There is sovereignty, there's national, there are our own personal what is it? Now I can't think of the word that she used. Like enrollment. What word am I searching for? Okay.
Like citizenship guidelines?
Citizenship. Or? Yes. Okay. Yes. There's citizenship. And so like I'm people say that all the time, white folks, mm-hmm. black folks, you know, they say, oh, I have Native American or Indian in my blood. And so, but they don't recognize our sovereignty, our citizenship, and the things that we go through to try and retain that sovereignty. And I was a little embarrassed, you know, I'm like, oh, dang, I'm not supposed to say that. And so ever since, I have not said that. So I'm really eager to learn more about this oversight in history that we rarely talk about, you know, Native American and African American indigeneity.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm just fascinated because just the Black and Indigenous intersections, right? What or one scholar, Tiffany, she called that Black Shoals, where those things intersect. Mm-hmm. I am extremely fascinated with that. And I can't wait to hear some of your responses to some of these questions we have today. But how about we start with you? Because you have direct connections to these ethnic groups uh-huh. and tribes that are right here. Carnisa, we could look. We could look across the way right now and probably see some of those territories that these nations that Elena is talking about.
For sure.
Yeah,
the signage post. So sorry, Elena, what were you saying?
Well, like this Western space, I think, is obviously so full of Native American history. But it's also full of Black history. Like, Black folks have been in these spaces almost as long as Europeans have. So it's nice to be able to kind of bring that story and that narrative to various audiences.
Wonderful. So you start from the point of view of your family history. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So the core of all of my work is the fact that when I was an undergrad at UC Santa Barbara, I learned that my father's family were enslaved by Native peoples, by the Chickasaw and Choctaw specifically. This was not a history that I was familiar with, although I had heard other people, like other African Americans, say similar things about, like, oh, I have Native people in my like family tree, or oh, this is why my hair looks this way, or grandma like had long straight Black hair. That's kind of something I often hear as well when I give talks around the country, because it's so common in Black families. Mm-hmm. Some of it is based in truth and some of it is mythology.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know the truth. How did you come to know that truth though? Like, was it through oral history? Was it through like some genealogy that you did? How did this story and this lineage kind of unfold to you?
Did you is it 23andMe?
I have done 23andMe. Okay. That was not around when I was first doing this. And so I went to kind of the knowledge keepers in my family, those who had actually continued to live in Oklahoma. My family, my grandfather had moved to California, so I grew up there, kind of away from that history and away from that space. And so it was only later on that I started asking questions in college, trying to figure out, you know, who am I and like what kind of matters to me and what communities am I a part of, that I then went to these people who already had this information and kind of realized that there was much to be built upon in kind of the academic realm.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Wonderful. And so you kind of dug in kind of head first, going from that vantage point. Now, what did you discover when you went to your family?
That there was a whole branch of my family tree that had always considered itself Choctaw and Chickasaw. Whereas my dad, if I asked him what he was, he would just say, oh, I'm a Black man, even though he's very, very light skinned, often mistaken for a white person. And so he wasn't interested really at all in exploring, you know, what it means that I have this phenotype. And clearly that means there is some other sort of ancestry here, you know, other parts of my family history that perhaps I'm not aware of. And so it was interesting to see different parts of my family and what kind of knowledge and memories they held and how different that was for the sorts of identities that they related to.
Yeah. You know, I think it's so important that we, like you, I love that you said the knowledge keepers of our families and how much of the intergenerational conversations that we're having or we're not having is contributing to, you know, who we are today and how we feel a sense of belonging in our family and even in our ancestral histories. So I love that you took that time to kind of have that conversation. What What prompted you to have that conversation, though?
I am a person who has always been a little weird. Like, not, I didn't make friends
True,
easily.
me too.
Like, I mean, it's just true. Like, I have interests and, like, it's only now in my like 30s that I've found people who, you know, like to talk about reading or writing and the sorts of things that I was thinking about since I was like 10. And so in college, I did not fit with the Black Student Union. Like, not that there weren't obviously, you know, intelligent people there who liked to read and write, but just no one I clicked with. And the other clubs and like the newspaper, I was part of that, like nothing made sense to me. And so I kind of wanted to know, you know, maybe there's some other organization that I'm missing that would also speak to, you know, who I am and who my ancestors are. And so in wanting to explore who they were, I kind of found myself through that.
So you were looking for belonging.
Yes, yes. That's a great way of putting it.
Wow. You're on college. On a college campus, you're looking for belonging. You're looking to see where you fit in. Who is like you? You're probably walking around student union, the dorms, wherever. Like, ah.
Yes.
This person could be like me. And you have this conversation. And were you at that point, would you say, as you said, your father considers himself a Black man? Mm-hmm. So I imagine there's certain markers or, you know, things about Black identity you had deeply embedded yourself in that you're just like, when you discovered that this other side, what was your immediate reaction? Was like, oh my goodness, you know, like, could you start to identify parts of you that you're like, oh, I could see?
Well, there are like so many conversations in the Black community about, you know, like what is Blackness, obviously, and
yes.
But the sort of cultural touchstones that I would often run across with African-American folks that I tried to connect with, I didn't have. Like, I didn't grow up in the Black church. I grew up actually a Jehovah's Witness, which is a pretty white organization. I did
People
not
were running away from you, child.
Right. You ain't got none and it's my birthday.
Hiding when I knock on the doors, yes. I didn't know how to play spades. I hadn't seen like Baby Boy or like all of these movies and music and like things I wasn't allowed to, you know, interact with as a child and a teenager. And so I didn't know who I was in the regard that there was a certain kind of image of who a Black person was that now is far more diverse. But I feel like when I was growing up, it was not that way. And so I was like, well, who am I? Obviously, I'm not really Black. Like, I'm an Oreo, as I keep getting called. Like, and so I was looking for other people who were struggling with identity, I guess, in various ways. And that is what I found in the Native American community, because they have similar conversations about who is really Native and like, what does a Native person look like? And what are real Native interests? And like, if you didn't grow up on the res, then you're not really Indian.
Right.
And so I found a community in that regard, and that we were all struggling in different ways.
Yeah. That's really good. You know, conceptions of Blackness are so exclusive and typically monolithic, right? You know, we think that we all have to have seen Baby Boy and know how to play games and know
but that
how to
is
play
true.
Domino.
That is true. If we haven't seen Baby Boy and we don't know how Yvette and Tyrese,
if
we can't quote lines, I'm
lessons.
Sorry.
Right.
You're not a citizen of Dr. Umar's nation.
Consciousness. You know, but really, and like it, even myself, someone who grew up middle class as a Black woman, you know, when I got to college, I felt that I had to learn how to play spades. I had to learn how to play dominoes because I need to find my sense of belonging in this group. And so when I started like looking at some of the work that you've done, Dr. Roberts, and you know, I thought it was very interesting in the video that I watched about your family, about this ancient civilization prior to European contact in Illinois. What was that called?
Oh, Cahokia.
Cahokia. And And then it kind of segues into now this European contact where Europeans are coming to America and they brought slaves with them. And I was so confounded. I'm like, well, why did the Native Americans choose to adopt the practices of the European instead of say, man, those Negroes, cool. I want to be with them. You know, like
freedom is what we do with what's been done to us.
True, very true. So why do you think those allegiances in the early European contact were formed? Why perhaps wasn't it different? Why didn't they choose us?
That is exactly kind of what I'm trying to show with my work, that these are active choices and that there were paths taken in different ways by different communities. And so on the East Coast, people like the Narragansetts, the Pequots, the Wampanoags, like people like Pocahontas's people who have been kind of for a long time interacting with like the British since they settled there, they have more kind of Black interaction and are incorporating Black people in a far different way than the five tribes that I study are. And so they do sort of choose to reject, at least in this earlier period, this racial hierarchy that is being created around them. And so they have individual connections and they don't see Black people as all the same. Whereas the five tribes see a way to better their lives. And so they say, you know, clearly Europeans and then later Americans are creating a labor system that revolves around this one group of people, Africans, mm-hmm. for the most part. And if we want to get in good with them, then we have to also make the choice to adopt this idea and along with it, this economic system that could improve our own economic status.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you take up these arguments in this book that you go on to write, and you're exploring, as I said, you know, these very interesting questions that I've kind of explored myself, but on the Caribbean African side, I too had to struggle with not knowing, still don't know how to play spades.
Somebody who
studies Blackness, once I get to, you know, learning how to play spades, I'm claiming I'm African American. I'm no longer, I'm making that leap from Jamaican to African American. But, you know, we were talking about conceptions of Black identity, you know, conceptions of Native identity, right? And this is all happening within the context of European colonization, imperialism, hegemony, all of that kind of stuff. But who is Native American, who is Black, turns on different kinds of ideas. And I want you to tell our listeners, you know, especially where, you know, blood quantum and all of those things are concerned in the Native American world, you know, how that gets defined. Are you on the roster? You know, how that get to define indigeneity, you know, for Native Americans, or at least, you know, the civilized tribes versus some of the other tribes.
Well, as peoples who are engaging in various battles and wars over land or resources, or just because they dislike a group before European contact, Indigenous peoples in North America had always had processes of absorbing and adopting people that were different from themselves. And mm-hmm. so the tribes that we know of today are themselves usually an amalgamation of various peoples that have, you know, won or lost various battles. And so they accepted that identity was not about necessarily ancestry or quote unquote blood, but it was about, you know, whether you're a part of this community through time spent with them as well as through various rituals. And so the creation of blood quantum and the idea that Native identity can be measured in any sort of biological way is completely new, and it's completely created and shaped by Europeans and Americans. And that happens over time as Europeans and Americans create this idea of a Native American person has to, on one hand, be knowledgeable about their language and have a quote unquote traditional culture, as in like before Europeans came. And so kind of trapped in a what is it called? Like a time machine in a sense, in order to be really Indian. And then on the other hand, they also want Native people to assimilate and change their ways in order to become civilized and survive along with white Americans who are supposedly far more advanced than them. And so people like the Five Tribes run into actual issues because they're accepted more and they receive preferential treatment because they are seen as more civilized. But the more civilized they become, and especially the more they intermarry with white Americans, as they're being encouraged to do, the less Indian they're seen as. And so when you have then this other group, Africans, Africans are seen as, you know, the bottom of the racial hierarchy. And so intermarrying with them or procreating with them is seen as lessening Native identity in a negative way. And so almost kind of creating a downward trajectory toward, this is not a word, decivilization, let's say.
Oh, yes. You're going back to human civilization zero.
Right.
You're going back to Australopithecus.
And so they have to balance all of these varying ideas that are being thrown at them. And ultimately, they realize that there actually is no winning, because either way, you're either too Indian and you need to be, you know, assimilated or put on a reservation, or you're not Indian enough. And then you just kind of eventually become American. And like, why should we continue to allow you to have tribal sovereignty, because you're really not a specific Native nation anymore? Mm-hmm. And so today, like, that's really what my second book looks at. Like, why are Native nations carrying on these same very harmful ideas of blood quantum when they really all know, if they study their history, that that is not their traditional way of kind of measuring who is or is not Native. And it really is just leading to an elimination kind of politic, that eventually you will have zero Native identity. Wow. Because of course people intermarry with other groups of people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sit tight through this commercial break. We'll be right back.
I'm Denisha Simpson.
And I'm Joy McGowan.
And we are the co-host to the Resilient Black Women podcast. Our podcast is all about demystifying mental health for Black women, women of color, and women everywhere.
You can learn more about our work with our nonprofit and our podcast by visiting resilientblackwomen.org.
You can also listen to our podcast at KUAF.com or subscribe to our podcast on any streaming platform.
Welcome back.
So this is interesting in a way that, okay, the natives, they have this encounter, colonization and settlement, and with slavery, we're needing more land and we're seeing expansion and we get in the Trail of Tears and natives are resettled over in Oklahoma and all of this kind of stuff. And they have their own enslaved people that they're taking with them on the Slave of Tears. And we're seeing this kind of an interesting interaction of Blackness and indigeneity in various ways, whether it's where identity is concerned, but also as Native Americans are co-opting the ways of Europeans and so on. I have a question about for Black people over in Oklahoma and elsewhere on indigenous territory. You know, it's a question that I deal with in my own work in Liberia. For African Americans and Caribbean people who go over to Liberia and settle on indigenous African land, the 16 indigenous tribes who were in Liberia before the American Colonization Society created that colony and tried to deport African Americans there, right? Are African Americans colonizers, settlers? Are they doing that same work of imperialism and colonization that the white people were doing? Are African Americans in Oklahoma who go west, who are on indigenous territory, are they also colonizers and imperialists as we see the white folks who occupied and settled those lands.
I gotta make sure my edge is still here because you're snatching at them right now. Okay.
Okay, I have to answer that.
I didn't come for no wigs or no wig lines.
So the first stage of that answer is that you talked about the Trail of Tears. You talked about the way Black people are, you know, living within these nations for generations often. So they're creating a unique culture that is, you know, just like African-American culture is a mixture of African, you know, the various ethnicities and languages and names and various, you know, white European cultures and identities. So are these people who live in these nations. And so I don't call them African-American in the book because they're not. Like, they are Black Cherokees or Black Creeks or Black Chickasaws and Indian freed people after the Civil War. And so those people actually think of themselves as different from African-Americans often. But both of those groups of Black people, Indian freed people and African-Americans, yes, like literally they are living on indigenous land. So literally they are settlers. But that doesn't mean that all of them are, you know, they're not necessarily killing Native folks. They're not necessarily kind of espousing the same rhetoric of manifest destiny. But some of them are. Like some of them, like some of the Black leaders who are buying up plots of land and trying to get African Americans to
Buffalo
migrate.
Soldiers and
Buffalo soldiers in a different way are like literally forcing Native people onto reservations and clearing their land for Western expansion.
Right.
There are many ways that Black people are part of this project, either actively or passively, and benefiting from it, even though they are obviously still been like suffering from racial discrimination of their own.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to hear it like that, because when you all are saying indigenous lands or native lands, I'm thinking reservations, Black folks on reservations. But now, you know, challenging even the colonization of my own mind to say, no, look again.
It's all indigenous land.
It's all indigenous land. Yeah. You know, Turtle Island is all indigenous land. So yes, that's all.
That's interesting to me. And I read a piece, you know, Dr. Roberts, by Taya Miles on that, where I think you guys might be having some kind of a historiographical debate there, right? About settlers, right? Because if we think about colonization and imperialism and indigenous land, as Carinesio was just saying, you know, but when we think about the grammar that was created, right, and kind of injected into ideas about colonization, when we kind of project that onto Black people, right, you know, who are in these kind of subordinate positions in
I don't know if you can enslave us and then call us colonizers.
Taya is one of my mentors. I love me some Taya. She blurbed my book and she told me when she read my book, like, this is a great book. I don't agree with this specific term. And like, some people do, some people don't. Like, I totally get that. That's totally fine with me. As long as we acknowledge that, you know, people being brought forcibly across the ocean is one thing. Like, Black people being forced to be enslaved on this space is one thing. But then how are they handling freedom, and how are they kind of utilizing sometimes the language of that white oppressor to better their own positions? Like, we have people among kind of the same realm as Frederick Douglass saying, like, literally, these people are uncivilized and they're not using this land. So federal government, you should give us African-Americans money to settle on their land. Like, that is actively being part of the project, in my opinion. And not every African-American is saying that. But
there's some detractors.
For sure.
I think that is an interesting undisciplined perspective of how we talk about you know,
abolition. Disciplined, with this Black and indigenous and you know, the various probably methodologies that has to go in this.
And how we've learned acquired facts that sometimes cover the truth, you know? So facts can be facts, but facts can cover the reality of truth. I think that it was in your video or somewhere, something I watched recently. But you know, that's a very interesting perspective, because we're, and I wonder, you kind of made this distinction between the five tribes and the other native nations that were surrounding them. And so I wonder, were these conversations happening distinctive or respective to those different groups? That were we talking about the five tribes? Were we talking about, you know, the outliers, I'll call them? You know, like, I wonder how that distinction was taking place in this conversation. And I don't know that you can answer that or speak to that, but it's just making me think about that. Because I imagine our interactions would have been different with them.
I don't know of any, like, yeah, conversations or letters or things like that that I've seen. But there definitely are African Americans who are aware of that history of Black people settling among people in the East and people who are mixed race, Black and Native. There are discussions amongst Native people about, like, what's happening to various tribes based on how they're treating Black people. So the five tribes after the Civil War, the reason they're so resistant to really kind of allowing Black people to have prominent roles in their nation or adopting them as citizens is because the people that I mentioned in the East Coast before who have those sorts of relationships, they run into trouble because then the U.S. government says, well, you're Black people now. Like, you've intermarried with these Black people, you have mixed race kids, so maybe you shouldn't have that reservation. And so they had, like, battles sometimes for, I don't know, almost 100 years to get back those pieces of land and that sovereign relationship with the government, because they did reject that racial hierarchy and they did allow Black people into their nations. So it's like, I'm in my work, I'm always like, well, obviously inequality is bad, obviously racism bad, slavery is bad. But then on the other hand, I acknowledge that it is a survival strategy in this earlier period of time.
Yeah. I mean, we're even talking about it now, like, you know, how, you know, Black folks aren't marrying and producing with other Black folks. And so what will be the standard or the conception of Blackness 50 years from now, you know? So I think there's still an ongoing conversation in reality. So I can have historical empathy with that.
Is it the Cherokees who in the court case were forced to recognize Black people as citizens?
Yes.
Oh dear, y'all had to let the courts come on.
Not y'all the institution.
Y'all got the popo involved.
The people.
The congregation did not please. Right. But the Choctaw and the Chickasaw, where are they in their nation, in their tribes, with regard to Black citizenship? And can you explain that whole Cherokee thing and why it had to get to the courts?
So after the Civil War, after Oklahoma statehood in 1907, Native nations are basically told by the federal government, like, you kind of no longer exist as your own entities. Now you're part of the state of Oklahoma. And so they kind of went into, let's call it a hibernation phase, where they still had some abilities to function as a government, but, like, they couldn't pick their own chief. They cannot change their constitution. And so they did not have the kind of full rights to exercise sovereignty. But in the 1970s, there was kind of a new wave of federal government representatives who said, you know, we should allow Native people now to function as governments once again. So they gave them back these sorts of powers. And some of the first things that the Cherokee, Creek and Seminole and Choctaw did was they pushed Black people out over the next two decades, either by referendum or literally allowing people to vote and say, like, should we kick out Black people? Like, imagine that, like, voting on other citizens. And so
did they kick the whites out?
No, they did not.
Absolutely not.
You could be white and Indian. White and Indian is fine. Black and Indian is not fine. And that's kind of had the case for many nations across the country.
Right. Luna Pesco, don't collect $20.
Right. Go back.
And so different descendants, freedmen descendants in the Creek, the Seminole, and the Cherokee nations launched court cases first in the nation, because all these nations have their own Supreme Courts. So going up through that process and either winning or losing. And if they win, then eventually, like, the attorney general says, actually, I'm still going to fight that. Then that's when they have to go to, you know, whatever U.S. court The Cherokee descendants happened to go the furthest. And so in 2017, they ended up in the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C. D.C. ruled, Cherokee Nation, you have to recognize these people as citizens again, or we're not going to give you the money for your housing that you're supposed to get from the federal government. So basically using the carrot or the stick.
Oh, dear.
They finally relented after spending millions of dollars on this legal battle over something they had agreed to in a treaty in 1866. And now they have a chief who is interested in welcoming back Black Cherokees and finally saying, what we did was wrong. That was racist. Like, let's inform all of these Cherokees that we have this long history with Black people in our nation. He's putting into the national government different projects to like preserve Black Cherokee history, to reach out to Black Cherokees to get them to enroll. And so actually creating a broader Black Cherokee base. Mm. And he was reelected. And so obviously his policies are popular enough and enough Cherokees agree that this is the right thing.
Dr. Roberts, I need to hear you say something. I need to hear if the checks were ran. Was there reparations for the people?
Well, it's a question of what is reparations. Uh-huh. So in the treaty I mentioned in 1866, when the federal government basically forces these Indian nations to free their slaves after the war, and then it forces them to give them land. So like my family has land, every Cherokee freedman got land, every Black person who was a slave in those four nations got land. Mm-hmm. And so that could be considered reparations. Like that's what African Americans in the States wanted. They wanted land. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't come with an apology or an acknowledgement that what they did was wrong.
Okay. But were those lands in Native nations? And if those Native nations were reduced by different eminent domain or institutional violence by the United States that reduced the amount of land, did that mean that Black folks or Native folks lost that land in that circumstance as well?
That land came from their holdings because the U.S. government is, in 1866, basically saying, we're going to eventually absorb you into the United States. So this is eventually going to become a territory and then a state. And so we're going to parcel up your land and we're going to give every Indian person a piece of land and we're going to give every Black person in these nations a piece of land. So their Black land holdings come from Native nations holdings because they're forced to give that up. So they're not even really making the active decision to give if we wanted to call them reparations. It's being done for them by the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm. And it's not Black capitalism that gives all these Black people land over there in Black Wall Street in Oklahoma.
Right, yes.
One time the government is our ally when it suited them.
Mm-hmm. So this idea of Black folks wanting to protect for themselves Native lands is this idea that Black folks are being imperialist. Yeah.
In a sense, yeah. They have various rights within tribal nations. And so there is like they would have a motivation to keep tribal nations intact. But they also benefit from having those individual allotments and the federal government coming in and saying, you have to do these things. Like they know that it's not the nations themselves who have agreed to free them in the first place. It's the federal government. So it kind of makes sense in a way that they would then maybe more identify with this entity that has guaranteed them their emancipation and this land and these sorts of opportunities that their Native enslavers maybe would never have.
Mm, so that same similar choice that the five tribes made with the earliest European arrivals for survival. You know, my flesh is like whoo leaping like okay, I'm this some good challenging of you know my what I've known, what I've come to accept, like or to not think about, you know, to think about you know as America the entity took on more land and pushed natives off of their land and then us resettling that land and then calling it historically Black communities.
Well, they're expanding.
I'm
they're expanding.
Turmoil.
they're expanding for slavery too, right? To enslave. So they are exercising this capitalist drive is disadvantaging Black people and Indigenous people in different ways.
At the same time.
They want native land, but they want Black people's labor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The cognitive dissonance is wild right now.
that's very interesting. Dr. Roberts, so you're marrying in your work, you're marrying Southern and Western studies, you're bringing in Reconstruction into the West. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I wanted it to be clear that there is a part of the Civil War happening in the West. In Oklahoma, there are 14 battles fought. Then there is a Reconstruction project happening in the West. So kind of everything that's happening in the East or South is happening in the West, just in a slightly different way. So with Reconstruction, as I've kind of said and alluded to, there are ways that Reconstruction is more successful. Because in the West, you don't have white citizens. Like, Indian territory is only Native folks. The white government isn't afraid to anger Native folks. And so they do things in these Indian nations that they refuse to in the South, because the South is white people, and they eventually want those white Southerners to kind of welcome being Americans again. Whereas
I was going to say one time for the people is something I need to ask you before you get into telling us about how Reconstruction. What side did the Indigenous folks fight on in the Civil War?
Both, technically. So just in the U.S., just like they're divided, these Indian nations are divided. So some people are like, I'm going to fight to maintain slavery. Some people disliked slavery and never supported it, so they fight for the U.S. Some people think the U.S. is probably going to keep its commitments to Native people and sides with them. Some Native people think, no, the Confederacy is a better deal because they're a new government. They haven't screwed us over yet, so maybe they make more sense. There are multiple reasons that people would, kind of be interested in either side. And then some people don't want to fight at all and just kind of leave.
Mm-hmm. You know, but I feel like most of the material in what I've seen in the, your website and things, that so you had the big five that were really fighting on the side of the Confederate, protecting the institution of slavery and their right to own slaves, mm-hmm. until later, they are forced to, what was the treaty? I can't remember the name of the treaty.
The Treaty of 1866.
But was there a majority, or was there an equal split, or was it like the distinction that you made earlier, where the big five were kind of working with the Confederate kind of side of belief in things, or in the other one, and the others were working with the Union? What does that divide look like, and how were they making those choices?
More Native people throughout the U.S. Are fighting for the Union. Mm-hmm. The five tribes are probably the most Confederate of those Native people fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Chickasaw and Choctaw within that are the most Confederate, whereas the Cherokees are almost evenly split.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. This is certainly interesting terrain for me here. Just thinking about indigeneity globally, right? We often don't tend to think of Black people as indigenous. Indigenous studies, that's not there's so many indigenous tribes. You hear about indigenous tribes in Europe and maybe Asia and all of that kind of stuff. You don't tend to hear about Black people as indigenous. One thing that has fascinated me, just thinking about indigeneity in Jamaica, the Maroons, right? The first Maroons were indigenous people, the Cimarrones, who ran away from the Spanish, and then they would be later joined by the Africans, in their community, as they're making community. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to me, because in Jamaica, the history is that it's these ethnic groups from Ghana, usually, that created the majority of these Maroon communities, the five Maroon communities in Jamaica and elsewhere. But a friend of mine became the chief of the Akampong Maroons recently, and wow, he's now meeting with indigenous leaders, you know, and harkening back to the indigeneity and kind of combining that indigeneity, right, of the Maroons being historically indigenous and Black, and with the treaty that the Maroons signed with the British, recognizing their freedom and saying that Jamaica, the Akampong area they where they're living, is not really Jamaica. It's a sovereign territory that was recognized way in the 18th century by the British, way before independence. So it's to me, it's very fascinating how indigeneity has been used, the different uses of indigeneity. How do you come across that in your work, in your studies globally?
Well, the, like, I don't know, one of the like three arguments of the book are that various groups of people use arguments about who is more civilized to claim an indigenous kind of identity to Oklahoma. So before the five tribes are forced to remove to what becomes later the state of Oklahoma, there are already native people there. So people like the Comanches and Apaches and the Osage, they already claim that space and claim that they have lived there thousands or even longer than that. But they're not kind of appealing to white Americans in the same way that the five tribes are. So they're forced off and they don't have the same sorts of rights as the five tribes. And so then the five tribes come in and then say, well, this is our land now and you did nothing to it. Like, this was a wilderness, just like white people would say. We're the ones civilizing it. So we're the real indigenous peoples in this space and we have the actual legitimate claim.
Right.
You know, because Black folks are saying, you know, there's been this debate about Black indigeneity.
It's difficult. It is.
I need some water. Black folks, you know, and saying that, well, we are the Native Americans as well. That even up until it wasn't that Black folks first had contact with North America when Europeans arrived, but that we were here beforehand. I, of course, have no legitimate facts to back that up, but that is, I don't, but that is just a conversation that is being had. And I want to know.
I asked Tiffany, I was like, when did this strain of argument that people were here? I was like, there are people, there are hordes of people on the interwebs.
That's been around a long time.
That people did not come on slave ships. That people are indigenous. You know, and I mean, we might have read Ivan van Sertima's book and all this other, they came before Columbus. But there are other people who are like, no. There were people who are indigenous. And I was like, when did this happen? Like, they had a meeting, Al Sharpton called a meeting. and I do not know when this happened.
Who knows?
Have you heard that? Have they been showing up at the Indigenous Studies Conference?
Oh gosh, I mean, that I don't think so.
You don't know who is indigenous.
Well, and they use like statues of like the Olmecs and people from Mesoamerica to say, well, look, they have broad noses like Black people, or look, they have big lips, that like these are the real like Africans.
But I think that's before that. They're referring to some indigeneity, even before Van Sertima's claim of Black people being in the New World. I think.
And but mitochondrial Eve. So I mean, if we were the cradle of civilization, then how did we not crawl throughout this mighty land?
I've seen in my own studies as well, you know, looking at African American and Caribbean colonization in Liberia, I've seen claims by people like Richard Allen and other free Blacks. They're like, we are the first cultivators of the land. I was like, now, Richard, I love you as a former AME, But I might have to stop you right there, sir. It's like, you know, these are the claims that Black people are making, that we have mixed our blood and our tears and our sweat with this land. And we were the first cultivators. I was like, let's stop with this.
Right. You know? I wonder what facts, what evidence do we need to prove or disprove these?
But it's the internalization of this kind of a productivity, the capitalist productivity narrative, mm-hmm. right? That they're internalizing to make an argument against the Europeans who are sending them back to Africa,
mm-hmm.
you know, and displacing the Native Americans in making that argument, you know?
Right.
So it's very fascinating. You know, what's going on there, those kinds of intersections.
Go ahead.
Building on that, like, I hear similar things in conversations about reparations, because reparations initially were a call for land. And even today, people talk about money, yes, but they also talk about land, ignoring the fact that that land is originally Indigenous folks' land. And like, what would that mean if our idea of, you know, freedom and reconciliation is in fact taking land from someone else?
Mm. You know, it's hard for me to, in knowing that natives enslaved Black people, it's hard for me to be like, oh, well, I care about your land.
I mean, true, but
I don't care about your land.
That wasn't all Native folks. That was only a small portion of Native folks.
But I wonder, in because we were getting to the West and you were talking about the distinction, like the distinct culture that Black and Native American culture kind of produced. What did that look like? And how was it specific to the way to the mixture of Black culture and Native indigeneity?
Well, there are foods with kind of like various herbs and recipes that Native people use that they would then be forced to cook for their slave owners, but then also change it a little using maybe like parts of recipes taken from various African ethnicities, the sorts of songs that make their way into Black churches or Native churches. I don't know if you're familiar with Swing Low Sweet Chariot.
Yes.
That is from a Black Choctaw.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Who grew up in a church that was Black and Native, and then who later became a lyricist and composer. People who spoke various Indian languages as well as English. So all the ways that we think of someone sharing a culture and living in someone's space, even forcibly, creates this melding of identities for both groups.
That would be an interesting
Black Seminoles, yeah.
Black Seminoles, all these different groups. Sorry,
Craig. I would love to go to a museum like that. You know, like what were these recipes, and how did African religion at all, if it did, impact the way that Native Americans practiced their spirituality? You know, like,
we have a bunch of Aimee churches in Indigenous territory. A friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, Christina Dickerson, cousin.
Oh, right? Yes, her book's great. Yeah.
That's my sister girl right there. She writes about the Aimee Church in Indigenous territory. She's done a lot of research down there in Oklahoma, and you know, the kinds of collaboration that we see between Black and Indigenous people, the kinds of kinship relationship. She wrote this very good article called "They Call Us Cousins," that is extremely fascinating. But along those lines, Dr. Roberts, I was wondering, in researching this book and your next book, in terms of methodologies, what are the Black and Indigenous ways of knowing and doing and finding out things? You know how Black people are like, we don't have no recipes, we just sprinkle till the ancestors tell us when to stop. What are some of the Black and Indigenous ways of knowing that you engage in getting to knowledge, right? Ideas of knowledge from Black and Indigenous perspective that you kind of deal with or go about? Kind of decolonize this thing.
Yes. Well, for the first book, a lot of it was the recognition of and valuing oral and family stories.
Yes.
which has become more and more like increasingly accepted in history, but was not even like 10, 15 years ago thought of as something that was, you know, academic or anything that might have value. And so, yes, like verifying with documentation when possible, but also saying, even if this story is not true, like it tells us what, you know, African-Americans or Native people think is important to pass on. And what does that say about the way they think about themselves and their communities? And so making that a part of my first book was important to me to really kind of put myself into this story and say like, this is literally why I'm writing this book. And this is why this history is so important to me. The second book, I would really like to include origin stories from, if I can find my aunt's African ancestor going way back, I would love to look more into, you know, whatever tribal affiliation they have and use those stories. But the Choctaw and Chickasaws have migration stories and stories about how their people came to be. And so I'd like to include that as kind of part of the story that I'm telling about my other part of my family, because the second book is looking at the enslavers who are also a part of the story. And I think in order to understand how my ancestors' life really was like, I have to understand the people who were holding them in bondage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think though, this, you know, we've kind of run through and redisciplined ourselves about this idea of collaboration and kinship between African folks and Native folks. So going forward, what do you think, what does collaboration between the Black community and Native communities look like today? Irrespective of whether Black folks are identifying or learning or recognizing their Indigenous roots, but just as two communities that are, I feel like, should be in support of one another and should be, you know, rallying for, you know, whatever causes are impacting their community today. What do you think that collaboration and kinship between these two communities looks like today or should?
Well, there is a kind of long tradition of Black and Native people showing up for each other in various ways and times and spaces, like in the 60s and 70s, the Red Power movement interacted with and worked with the Black Power movement, you know, sharing some of their language and ideas about civil rights and sovereign rights with the, you know, Dakota Access Pipeline protests back in 2015 and 2017. There were Black Lives Matter activists at those kind of rallies and Black people calling attention to the importance of environmental rights for not only Native communities, but also Black communities who are disproportionately affected by that. Mm-hmm. With the, you know, 2020 and 2021, there were a lot of conversations between Black and Native people about how Black people maybe don't recognize as much the importance of land to Native people, as well as Native people saying, you know, we also have a huge statistically significant amount of Native folks in jail. Mm-hmm. But because we're a smaller population, people don't know about that or maybe don't even care. And so we share so many of the same issues in the modern day that, yes, it only makes sense for us to be in conversation about how these impact both of our communities, because it all stems from colonization.
Right. But mm-hmm. what do we do? You know, like, what does that look like outside of, you know, showing up in protest? I wonder what kinship, you know, I feel like that or those protests or those demonstrations are really for collaboration, but what does kinship look like for us in terms of like, I wonder if Native communities would be open to sharing their experience with slavery or their experience with land removal and their experiences mm-hmm. in their past with African folks in their relationships and their knowledge bases. And I wonder if they would be open to hearing what our experience has been if we had that such a historical record or like you said, knowledge keepers that could share that. I wonder what that kinship looks like between us.
I definitely think some people are. I am basing that off of the interactions I've seen on like Twitter or amongst artists who are doing like exhibits where they have both Black and Native pieces speaking to like interactions with like the police or with the racist state. But then there are certainly people who are still into the oppression Olympics. Well, like, was slavery really worse or was colonization really worse?
Right.
Ignoring the fact that actually both of our peoples have dealt with both of those things, like colonization as well as slavery. Like Native people were enslaved too. Actually, mm-hmm. they were the first slaves in the Americas, not Africans.
Right.
So there are definitely ways that events and intergenerational trauma and all of these stories can be shared in the same space. I think if people are interested and willing, I think it just kind of takes an outreach from maybe, you know, one group first to start it.
Because mm-hmm. I feel like Natives are not willing.
That is definitely true for some of them. Yes. Maybe yeah. most of them. I don't know.
And I don't know if it's like, you know, tribal secrets or sacredness that you're trying to, that some folks may be trying to like, not release knowledge that could be used against them, or I don't know, but you know, I'd like to get the Black delegation open into the table.
We got to call Dave Chappelle, see if he could have another racial.
Oh, character. God.
How dare you?
Together.
Like when we say decolonize our minds, like I think Native people need to start interpreting that as also quitting with the anti-Blackness. And not all of them realize that, I think, because it's just so natural. It's so natural to think of the stereotypes about Black people as true.
Right.
But they don't realize that that is the other side of the coin of their own oppression, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite interesting, you know, to think about just the psychology of that, of people who have been oppressed,
mm-hmm.
you know, what then they go on to do with other folks. We see that presently. It's something that have kept me up many a night when I was writing my own first book, and you know, it still keeps me up today thinking about that, just the psychology of like if you were deprived one thing and you have this kind of insecurity, you know, about your position in society or in your community, you know, what kind of behaviors that trigger in you then as a kind of protective or defensive mechanism then that may cause harm to others, sure. you know? But we're all healing.
All of us.
We're going to invite therapy. all of us to therapy under the cotton tree. You know? And we're going to get it together. We will. We shall overcome by and by. We still enjoy this conversation,
sure.
Dr. Roberts. This has been very educational for me. What about you, Karenisa?
For sure. I'm going to have a lot to grapple with and a lot more research to do and understanding to build. And I think our audience and listenership is going to be doing the same. I think this is an excellent conversation that invited everybody to the table. So.
Absolutely. We're going to take it to our other tables. We're going to go take this to our classrooms.
Take the table, okay?
Yes. And we're looking forward to your upcoming talk. So we're glad that you've whetted our appetites, and we look forward to the big shebang when you get here to the University of Arkansas. So thank you so much for coming to the Undisciplined Podcast, and we look for your second book when it comes out. You'll come back and tell us what the people have been doing.
Okay, because we're going to need to know. I need more. I'm going to keep drinking my water so my edges will be hydrated for all the pulling and snatching, okay?
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined. This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Karenisa Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African-American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African-American Studies Program and the Undisciplined Podcast on Instagram at UARK underscore AAST, or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you like today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.